Welcome to Registry Matters, an independent production. Our opinions are our own, and we don't take instructions from anyone but us. We are thankful for the support of our patrons. You make what we do here possible. And always remember, FYP.
Hey, recording live from FYP Studios East and West. Transmitting across the internet, this is episode 383 of Registry Matters. Holy crap, Larry, it's August 1st. Seriously?
That's what the calendar's telling us.
Jesus, man. So how are you tonight?
I'm nice and toasty with this heat dome parked over the western United States. It's lovely.
Tell me, what is a heat dome?
I don't know, but I certainly don't like it when I wake up and it's 100 degrees. Not really 100, but when it's 103 when I go to bed, it only drops to like 75. Normally, it drops in the 60s at night in the summertime. And we're having 74 is the low now.
You know, we were talking just a little bit before pre-show. How would you set up what you brought up something and then I said, oh, we have to talk about this other thing that's related to it. How would we set this up?
I don't know. You're the one that was going to figure that out.
Okay. So here's a quick little story. We were talking about, I guess I sent you an article a few days ago about the number of people that have been deported from the United States through both colors of administrations. And I mean, colors as in red versus blue. And you were surprised that it's kind of a balanced thing between both parties.
Well, it was the accidental ones I was concerned about. I'm thinking if you aggressively or deporting, you're bound to make a mistake sooner or later. So I'm saying it's going to be humorous when somebody who's a citizen gets deported. Lo and behold, quite a few have.
And then you went on to say, talking about people and their jobs, and then the Americans they're taking our jobs and all that, right?
Yeah, we've got 8 to 10 million unfilled jobs that we can't fill. But the theory goes that these illegals are driving down wages and are taking Americans' jobs. And I'm just thinking about how horrible it is. They're taking our jobs that Americans won't take. And they're sending the money back to their loved ones. And they're paying taxes and supporting the economy here. But it's just horrible. We got to get these people out of here.
All right. Well, then that prompted me to think about a particular South Park episode. And this is old. This is an old episode. So if you can imagine the little animated cartoon, have you ever seen a clip of South Park?
Can't say that I have.
Oh, jeepers, man. Okay, so it's a really poorly animated comics TV show. But the whole point of the thing is they cover current events. And this is probably 15 years ago, maybe? And so, like, a portal opens up, if you can imagine. A little, like, a bubble kind of opens up. And an alien, you know, alien, illegal alien, but from another planet, alien, shows up, and the guy is willing to come work in, I think it's, where are they from? They're in Colorado. Is it Springfield, Colorado is where they're from? I forget where they're from. And he's willing, this alien, who doesn't speak any English, duh, he's willing to do work, and he's willing to take, like, almost nothing. And he takes that, does he go back home in the portal? I think he can't get home. Anyway, then the portal opens up, and more of them show up, and they're happy to do our just nasty, crappy labor. And at first, it's kind of okay, because the citizens of the town are very happy because they get this super cheap labor and they don't really have to do anything with them. They can treat them like crap and whatnot. And the next thing you know, they start doing good enough work and whatnot that the people are starting to notice, the people of the town notice that the aliens are taking their jobs. And so the people are standing up in the town hall meetings and they're saying, they're taking our jobs. And by the end of the show, Larry, everything just gets so bad that the phrase, they're taking our jobs, devolves and devolves and devolves from they're taking our jobs to they're taking our jobs. And then by the end, because they're just bitching about aliens.
Well, it's kind of a sore spot for me about taking our jobs, because I've readily confessed since we started this program, I'm not nearly as smart as a lot of folks. Pretty simple mind. But what I look at is simple facts. Simple facts are, we have millions of jobs we cannot fill in this country. And we have, like in our state here, we have anywhere from 18, 20, 25% of government jobs that can't be filled, which are usually pretty choice jobs that people would like to have with fringe benefits. We can't fill these jobs. And I don't understand what jobs they're taking from Americans because we cannot fill them with Americans. And then they posed one question to me. They said, well, why won't they hire Americans? Well, because they're not applying or they're not whatever. And they said, well, we should hire Americans, but they don't want the jobs. And they say, but we need to have Americans. I said, no, we need workers doing the jobs. And we go round and round. We go,
You make that distinction so cavalier.
we,
We need Americans doing. No, we just don't need someone to do the
well,
job.
in a country where the income tax is primarily the tax revenue in this country is 90% individual. So if we've got 8 to 10 million unfilled jobs, let me see, do a little bit of math. I don't have the brilliance with math, but let's just say that each person makes an average of 30,000 a year on those unpaid jobs. And they're all the way up to medical professionals, doctors, dentists, airline pilots. So they'd be, but just 10 million times 30,000. Well, how much Social Security revenue would be coming in to the system that's already strained? I just don't understand this obsession. And I don't understand in a free country why you want to require people to work. You have the choice of not working. If one partner in a relationship can carry the entire family satisfactorily, that's your prerogative. If you can support your kids without working and you can afford to buy them the Nikes and the iPhone or whatever they want, that's your prerogative. Why do you people obsess so much over Americans? I'm worried about workers. So that's my commentary for this week. We need workers participating in the workforce. I don't care who they are, as long as they're participating, they've gone through a process, they're in our tax system, in our databases. I don't care what nation they originate from.
I recall this was actually the time when I was locked up living in Georgia, and maybe it was 2010, and a particular governor had just gotten elected, and he was, I'm going to drive around in my truck and I will round them up personally, that kind of mentality.
I remember that, yes.
And I remember people in prison saying, "Well, I'll go work in the fields and pick the vegetables and the fruits and whatever they're growing." But I'm going to say that in general, this is certainly not everybody. But if I went out there, man, I am not going to be able to keep up with someone that's 20 years old and in shape and whatnot. I'm not saying I'm super out of shape. I'm just like at the time, I was in way better shape than I am now. However, all that said, Americans can't keep up either. There's that.
It's a strange thing. They have their hands raised with our antiquated quota system. They're wanting to come in legally, but their number never comes up on the lottery because the quotas are so outdated from 1986, I think was the last time that they've been adjusted.
I've
And
heard this.
they want to come in, and they're telling us, we will pick your crops, we will lay your asphalt, we will roof your houses, we will frame your houses, we will work in your chicken factories, we will do these jobs for you. And we're saying no. I would be saying yes, put your application in, let us check you to make sure you don't have any criminal history. You'll go through a DNA, we'll put you in our DNA database, all your biometrics. If you get in trouble, you'll be deported. But you're welcome to come here and work. I just don't have the brain power, I guess, to figure out what all the objection is.
I'm getting a ton of pushback from a particular former transcriptionist person that's saying, Larry, you're oversimplifying with H-1B visas for tech is built on lies and greed. All the big tech companies are firing Americans and then in turn around claiming they need H-1B and filing for them.
See, and I don't know anything about that. So if that's the true case,
And I mean, there's truth in it. I've heard of this, but I still would argue
I would
that
like
we
to I'd
need
like to see documentation from that, other than just being on the talk shows. Are Americans truly not able to get those jobs? Because I'm hearing from the little bit of contact I have that they can't hire people, period. Not that they're firing
Yeah,
people. Go ahead.
I've heard that there's many, 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 many IT jobs, and we just don't have the Americans to fill them. We don't have the technical skills for many of them. And I mean, maybe with all the Facebook and Microsoft and all the people being laid off because of AI right now. Maybe. Maybe, maybe, maybe. All right. Shall we move along?
Sure.
What are we doing tonight?
Well, we are going to have a lot of fun tonight. We what are we doing tonight? I've prayed about this for a long time tonight. We're getting ready. We were We're going to talk about something that's been discussed rather vigorously on the NARSL listserv. It's flock cameras. And flock cameras and the automated license plate readers and what the Fourth Amendment currently allows. Also, we were planning to have a PFR failure to register case that I think we've discussed in the past. Unfortunately, we don't have enough time to cover it properly this week, so we're moving it to a future episode. And the case is the state of West Virginia versus the Honorable Paul Gwaltney Jr. and William McGow. And then we have a comment from a listener that's rather sad. And then we have a question from a listener that maybe I can answer, but I doubt it. I really do. But anyway, we've got a couple. So that's what we got this episode.
Picture getting fingerprinted just for making a new email account. That's West Virginia, where registrants must report every username and screen name in person. A federal judge just let a free speech challenge move forward. Registry Matters digs into fights like this because it is a nonprofit, and your support literally funds the fight. Become a patron at patreon.com/registrymatters.
All right, well, this one is pretty sad story. Says, hey, Andy, I know that you're a super busy guy, but I wanted to send something your way in regard to a valid topic idea within our community. You may have covered this at some point already. I'm working my way back through your podcast from the beginning, currently on episode 13. Oh my God, Larry, he's got a long way to go, right?
He does, and those were the goofy ones before we had a system that we followed.
That's very true. But a young man at my treatment facility committed suicide last Halloween. He was at the 8-year mark of a 10-year sentence and seemingly doing good, on the surface at least. It was incredibly bizarre. Law enforcement didn't notify treatment, probation, or his family. Everyone thought he was on the run until someone within his family was notified a month ago. Notified almost 8 months after his death. We're in the system in so many ways. Fingerprints, DNA, butt prints, you know, all those things. So why did it take 8 months for anyone to notify treatment, probation, and his family? Bizarre! My wife and I and a few others and his sister, his victim, went to a small memorial service for him at a park. That's all he received, sadly, a small gathering at a park. Anyway, I thought I would pitch this to you and Larry, as we all know the heavy mental and emotional weight that this label and the cruel and unusual punishments that we endure daily. Thanks for all you do. Thanks for all you guys do. And that's from Vince.
And I thought about that and I decided to put it in because I don't generally have a habit of strongly defending law enforcement, but I do on occasion. And I'm not sure that I can see anything that they would have done wrong here. A death would trigger law enforcement if it's unattended. That is correct, if it's an unattended death. But then the body gets transferred to the medical authorities for autopsy and identify a source and cause of death to see if foul play is involved, which would bring law enforcement back into it. But since apparently there was no foul play mentioned here. I mean, it was suicide, but that's not self-inflicted. So, I mean, it's not worried that someone would be subject to prosecution. And so, therefore, the treatment people, perhaps maybe it would have turned up in some of the law enforcement checking that he was on the PFR list. But I don't know how they would know what family to notify unless he was carrying that information with him of who to contact in the event of an emergency. And I'm not sure that we could blame law enforcement for not notifying the family. And the way the system works here and in most states, if there's an unintended death after an investigation is completed and there's no foul play, they're held hoping that a family member steps forward. And most families miss their loved ones after a period of time, and they step forward and say, they start checking hospitals and morgues. And apparently he doesn't have a lot of close family ties of anybody that missed him.
Don't probation people take references, referrals, whatever? If you go rent a car, don't they take like your entire family tree in case you run off with the car or something like that? Doesn't probation have like next of kin, anybody to contact in case of emergency?
They likely and probably do. But the problem is he said that probation wasn't notified. And I'm saying I don't know that probation would have been notified, because when they found the dead body, their concern was to figure out, was the body subject to foul play?
Okay.
And so their focus was on getting him to the Office of the Medical Investigators, we call it, the coroner, whatever the appropriate authority was for an investigation. When the body was released saying it was self-inflicted death, there was no foul play to investigate. So perhaps maybe some board officer could have run him through the NCIC to see if he was on the PFR list, but I doubt all that stuff. I don't think it came together the way he thought it did. I don't think there was any conspiracy. Well, he's a PFR. We're not going to notify a soul. I just don't think the law enforcement is that sinister. I think it just was the protocols they followed. Remember, we're a protocol-driven society. The computer tells everything to do. And you've heard me gripe on private phone calls about my medical conditions because I can't get a doctor to actually practice medicine. For better or worse, they have to follow their playbook.
One last question, and gosh, did it just leave my brain? Yep, it left. Sorry, I'm old. It vanished. Poof, gone.
I'm sorry for the guy that this is all that he's got, and it's very sad. But I hate to point a negative finger at law enforcement. We do that all the time when it's justified, but this may not be justified.
I hear you.
Police drew a circle on a map and scooped up the phone locations of three totally innocent people. This year, the Supreme Court finally called that a search. Andy and Larry break down what it means for your privacy. Patrons get bonus segments you won't hear anywhere else. Join the crew at patreon.com/registrymatters.
All right, well then, moving over to a question from a friend of mine, Ryan. I'm a longtime listener of the show, and I'm trying to get into business myself and helping other PFRs since getting hired has been become a challenge. Unfortunately, the modern market requires me to market through large-scale social media businesses like Facebook and Instagram, and these platforms have policies against PFRs. From my armchair AI research, I've discovered that they are considered the marketplace of ideas, which means the government can't ban me from usage. However, the businesses themselves can ban me since they are private companies. It's a rather convenient way of preventing me from marketing my services to a wider audience and ensuring that I fail. I'd like to file a lawsuit against Meta for preventing me from reaching my market, but I do not know under what grounds I can sue. I don't care about the social media aspects of the platforms, as I consider them a waste of time. However, I do need to reach the people who may be potential customers. I'm in the IT field, and I'm helping a friend set up a business in home repair, but I have to keep telling him that I cannot do online marketing through these companies, in addition to not being able to sell my personal brand. Am I stuck spending loads of cash on a marketing firm when I know I could do the work myself? What avenues do I have for filing a suit against Meta?
I think you've got a recording for this.
Is this run by the? Is that what you want?
No.
This?
Run by the strangest collection of mis-
Sorry, no, not that
no,
one?
Not that one, Clinton.
Oh, that's one. Okay. So, but you don't think that Meta's run by the craziest bunch of lunatics and whatnot?
I'm not ready to say that. They've been pretty successful, but remember, this is out of my expertise level, out of my area of expertise. But he's spot on as far as they're considered private companies and they can ban people. And the closest comparison I can make was back in the 70s when I worked in a small town radio station. And advertising was desperately sought, but carefully reviewed for appropriateness. And there was advertising periodically that was declined by the station. And it was considered to be a proper use of their discretion because they were the protector of the public airwaves and community standards, as they were called at that time. And so I remember the owner, which was also the manager, declining a station for the station was sought after to advertise don't want to call it birth control, but family planning services in a small suburb of Atlanta in the 1970s. And he said, there's no way in the heck we can run anything like that on this station. And they declined it. So what, as best I can understand it, he's wanting to advertise his services on Meta platforms. Do I have that right?
I mean, probably that and further like LinkedIn and other places, yes.
Okay, well, I would doubt that the jurisprudence as it's developed has evolved to give him much of a much strength for a challenge on this, because again, they're privately owned companies and they're selling advertising, and you would have to put forth a theory that you have a right to advertise, and I'm not sure that you do. Do you?
Would that potentially be a freedom of expression, First Amendment thing?
I don't know that advertising would be that. I've actually made the suggestion that people that want to communicate might be able to claim that it's a public utility with that theory, much like the electric company. If you have one unitary electric company, they can't decline service. They can put standards in place. You've got to put up a large deposit if you have bad credit or whatnot, but they can't just say, we won't serve you. But in this instance, since there are multiple, the court, when it looks at free speech things, they're looking at alternative platforms. Well, does Meta have the only method he has of reaching his customers? Would that be the only way he could reach them?
I'm going to definitely say that they are not the only one. They are certainly a significant one, where Facebook and Instagram are certainly a huge market. But you could do Google, and you, like I said, you could do LinkedIn. LinkedIn is owned by Microsoft. Google is obviously, well, they're owned by a company called Alphabet.
Well, it would be a very expensive lawsuit. I doubt he would find a lot of assistance. Maybe I'm wrong. I doubt he'd find a lot of people stepping forward to fund it. And Meta would have unlimited resources.
Yeah, they do. From a registry side, registrant side, particularly one in Florida, because that's where Ryan is, if he were to have mom use mom's account, because at least the way that I understand it, this has been a really long time, that a person has to be the owner of a business account. You can't go and say that I am the Larry Law Firm. I know that you're not a law firm, I'm making up something fictitious, and you can't just as its own entity register that. You would have to use the personal Larry to then create the business Facebook account. But so could he go and get mom to open up, use her Facebook account to then open up the Ryan IT Consulting website? Would that fly in the face of internet identifiers and the Florida telling them what accounts you have and then Meta tracking that down? I mean, if it's the Ryan IT Consulting company, it's not necessarily tied to his internet identifiers with the Florida registry. I'm just thinking, to me, that would be a way to go work around it.
It certainly does sound like it has potential, particularly if they made that relationship solidified on in a business agreement arrangement, where that it's not just voodoo, because I just about bet you in that 300 pages of disclosures in terms of service that you sign, there's something in there that says you can't do voodoo to avoid being truthful. But if he has a relationship with mom, and it's part of a legitimate business relationship, maybe that would fly. And then that would avoid having to be reported.
Could you then possibly, even using like LegalZoom or something like that, just set up some very basic incorporation things, and mom is a partner, and therefore mom could set up the business to market?
Well, that's above my level of expertise, but yeah. I would talk to a person who does that area of law and find out if they'll actually talk. And rather than you having to send a form in and wait for an AI bot to take a look at the form and respond back to you, but if you could actually have a one-on-one discussion with an attorney who practices in an area that would be similar to what we're trying to do here, that'd be a good question to ask. Because what if Florida thinks he should report that as one of his identifiers, and he doesn't, and he ends up getting prosecuted? I would never want to recommend anybody do anything that would get him prosecuted.
Agreed. And then even by extension, if you went to the person's office and you helped them, even looked over their shoulder and helped them do their marketing, that's not you doing it. It's their internet identifiers. I think I would personally go do it, Larry. If it were me, I would go into your office and I would take over your computer and I would set up your internet marketing for you while you're looking over my shoulder, and then I would walk out the door.
Interesting concept.
I don't like, that's what I would do. And, but you know, I don't, you say that I had the most unique experience with being on supervision that you've seen from anybody. So maybe I would get away with it, but somebody else would, like, as soon as they got near the other person's keyboard, they would get handcuffed.
Yeah, I hate to use you as the example, because the guy, it was so unusual. Yeah. It was so unusual what all that lately you do.
All right.
Alabama tried to bar a father from ever sleeping under the same roof as his own child for life with no off-ramp. A federal court just said parental rights are fundamental. Registry Matters walks you through the whole ruling. Patrons get every episode early and a feed with no ads. Support the show at patreon.com/registrymatters.
Well, like, to be continued, Ryan, I think that this should be continued dialogue of figuring out what you can do. Because, you know, in Florida, you are not the only person there. And there's a fairly large affiliate group there for NARSOL. Like, and they're pretty active, not necessarily effective, but they're really active and they have a lot of people. And I'm certain that you could find someone else that does similar work in Florida that could give you some guidance on what you could or couldn't get away with.
That's a good suggestion.
All right. Well, then, like I said, so like you said earlier, this is going to be a little bit different. There's no big Supreme Court decision to score, no bill working its way through some legislative body somewhere. This is a topic segment, and it's about surveillance. Specifically, it's about a company called Flock Safety. And I just want to set the table here because I've been down the rabbit hole in this one. I spent a few hours working through this one earlier today. Flock makes these automated license plate readers, which are called ALPRs. And they're cameras mounted on poles next to public roads, and they photograph basically every car that goes by. There was a federal decision, Schmidt versus the city of Norfolk, out of the Western District of Virginia in January, that we're going to use as the legal backdrop. But most of what I've got here is investigative reporting. The Electronic Frontier Foundation, or the EFF, did a year in review at the end of 2025. And then the outlet 404 Media has been filing public records requests. And I want to walk you through what these cameras actually are, because I think you're going to have a lot of questions.
I'm sure I'm going to have a lot of questions, but because I can tell you right now, I'm not that technically savvy. So you're going to be the one that's explaining how this box and contraption works. And I'm going to be the one asking the dumb questions when I don't follow what you're trying to say. Is that fair?
That is absolutely fair. So that's exactly how this is going to go. So let me start with the mechanism itself, because everything depends on it. A Flock camera is a stationary camera on a pole. It doesn't follow you around. It just sits there. When a car passes, it takes a photo. AI stuff, I don't even like calling this AI. This is more like machine learning stuff, but whatever. Reads the license plate off of that photo. And here's the part that people miss. It also records what Flock calls a vehicle fingerprint. The make, the type, the color, and any distinctive features. Roof racks, bumper stickers, dents. So even if it can't read the plate, it can log that a silver SUV with a roof rack and a Bernie sticker went by this intersection at 4:42 in the afternoon.
Huh. So let me make sure I got this so far. It's this camera on a pole. It photographs the car. It does not photograph me or the driver. It doesn't know if it's me driving or my wife driving or my neighbor who might have borrowed the car. It's just taking a photograph of the vehicle and cataloging all that data.
Correct. And hold on to that, because it's going to be the whole ball game later. The camera cannot tell who's driving. The court in Schmidt said this plainly. The Flock cameras, quote, do not provide information to users about the location of individuals beyond public roadways or outside of vehicles, end quote. And the court drew the contrast itself, saying that unlike a cell phone or an ankle monitor, quote, they do not follow individuals inside buildings, homes, or anywhere else, end quote. They photographed vehicles on public roadways where the stationary cameras were located.
So it's dumb as far as the device. It doesn't do anything. It's, in a technical sense, it's dumb. It knows the car was there. It doesn't know a person was there necessarily or who that person was.
Right. And now here's the data flow, which is the part I found genuinely surprising. When a camera took that photo, the image got uploaded to an encrypted server, and the data was, quote, securely stored for a designated retention period. But here's the thing. The police department did not hold that data. Flock held it. In Norfolk, the department had... Excuse me. Back up. Flock held it. In Norfolk, the department had 176 cameras. They paid Flock a subscription fee. The data lived on Flock's servers. The department was renting access.
Now, so say that again, because it's not a small point. The city of Norfolk deployed those 176 cameras. They collected images of every car in the city that went by, but they didn't own the pictures. A private company owned the pictures that were taken by the 176 cameras that some governmental entity paid for. Is that correct?
That is correct. So a private company owned the pictures. The locality paid a recurring fee, kind of like Netflix, Larry, and Flocks stored everything. The department logged in through a web interface or a mobile app with a username and password and could run queries. You could search a full or partial plate. You could search for those vehicles' fingerprint characteristics, or you could just pull up everything a particular camera saw during a window of time.
So I'm processing. The public paid to collect the data, and the vendor held the data. So one of my questions right up front is, who is actually holding this? And if is it even the government at all? Because I got to ask the police department for their records, and the records are sitting on a corporation server under subscription agreement. And that's a different animal. So it's not, in New Mexico, it's called Inspection Public Records. I could submit an IPRA request and they'd say, we don't have it.
Right. So yeah, it is a different animal, and it's a good instinct you've got there, because it's going to matter for who can get at it. Now, let me give you the retention piece, because you asked earlier and I want to answer it. In Virginia, a statute took effect July 1st, 2025, so just over a year ago, and it dropped the retention period from 30 days to 21 days. So the default now is a rolling 21-day window. After 21 days, the routine images age off.
Okay, well, 21 days, so that sounds like that there's a guardrail in place. 3 weeks, and it just, poof, it went away.
And it is a guardrail just like that. But read the opinion. The court said, quote, the retention period does not prevent the long-term retention of ALPR data that is downloaded from the Flock system, end quote. Downloaded. So the 21 days applied to the rolling database. If someone logged in on day one and pulled the data down into an investigative file, that copy was not on the 21-day clock anymore.
Oh, you're making my head spin. So that's my second question answered, and I don't like the answer. If retention is 21 days, what happens to what got downloaded on day one? And the answer is whatever the person who downloaded it wants to happen to it. I'm guessing the 21-day protects the stuff nobody bothered to grab. And that is really not much of a shield, is it?
Nope, not a shield at all. And even the court acknowledged in a footnote that at the very least, data involving an ongoing criminal investigation could be retained longer than the default. So the 3 weeks was the floor for a routine sweep, not a ceiling on anything anyone actually cared about.
All right. Before you get into the abuses, I know you've got a list. Let me plant the legal flag, because people need to understand why any of this is legal in the first place. Because the instinct of most folks is this can't possibly be allowed. So walk me through, why is it legal to do this?
All right, well, let's go over the plaintiffs in that case we just brought up a minute ago. So in Schmidt, Lee Schmidt and Crystal Arrington sued the city of Norfolk under Section 1983, saying the 176 camera network violated their Fourth Amendment rights. Their cars got photographed a lot. The opinion said approximately 475 and 325 times respectively over about a 4.5 months. Full plate matches on average 2 to 3 times per day. And the court, Judge Mark Davis, granted summary judgment to the city. The cameras were held constitutional. Now you take the law, sir, because this is where I hand it off.
This is the load heavy part. The whole case turned on the line in the Supreme Court. U.S. Supreme Court drew in a case called Carpenter. And before that, a case called Knotts. Maybe that's like Don Knotts, maybe?
It is. Could be Don Knotts himself.
The baseline rule.
Or Knott's Berry Farm.
The baseline rule quoted in the opinion from Knotts was that, quote, a person traveling in an automobile on public thoroughfares has no reasonable expectation of privacy in his movements from one place to another, end quote. That was the starting point. So if you're out in public on the road and everybody can see you, now I've said that myself, when you go out in public, you shouldn't get mad if someone takes a photograph of you because you have no expectation of privacy when you're in a public setting, be it street or public accommodation.
The only point I would argue against that one is someone taking a picture of you is different than being like photographed at every corner from here to the end of the, from here to the end, wherever your destination is. That would be my one pushback against you don't have privacy. However, these things are positioned all over the place. Sorry.
Yeah, and I tend to agree with you. See, I hadn't thought that through when I've pontificated that. It's one thing for someone to snap a picture of you. It's another thing for someone to chronicle every move that you're making. 400, yep. What did it say, 425 and 300, what it was, respectively, for the two people?
Yes, 475 and 325 for the two people.
Yeah, yep. So three times a day that they're chronicling every movement that they're making on the road. Now, that is not quite the same thing as taking a picture. I'll agree with that.
Yep. All right. Well, then, but so still, how does anyone ever win one of these kinds of cases?
You don't.
Okay. All right. We're done. Thanks.
So Carpenter was the cell phone case where the government pulled 127 days of cell site location data and could reconstruct a man's entire life. And Carpenter said there's a point where the tracking becomes so total that it does invade a reasonable expectation of privacy. The phrase the court used over and over was the, quote, whole of a person's physical movements, end quote. That was the line. Individual snapshots on a public road, no privacy interest, but a catalog of somebody's movements, and now you've crossed that. And I tend to agree with that logic.
And the Fourth Circuit had a case like that, right? The Baltimore one?
Yes. Leaders of a beautiful struggle. I've never heard of this until our research staff uncovered it.
Yep.
Baltimore, you're paying the research staff a lot of money.
Yes.
Baltimore flew surveillance planes over about 90% of the city, 12 hours per day. And the Fourth Circuit en banc said that crossed the line because that program, quote, tracks every movement of every person outside in Baltimore, end quote, and created a, quote, quote, detailed encyclopedic record that was the whole of your movements. That was the ankle monitor of every person in the city. So it's okay to put an ankle monitor on someone who's done something and track their movements because you're being punished. But I'm not sure in a free society we have the same opportunity to track everybody's movements.
So why then isn't Norfolk the same thing? Because from where I'm sitting, 176 cameras photographing every car sounds an awful lot to me like a plane flying over the whole city.
Because of exactly the limitation you told me to hold on to. The court said the Norfolk cameras were in 75 clusters across 66 square miles over 9 million feet of road. And the judge wrote the line I actually love, quote, under the best conditions, defendant's ALPR system has many thousands more blind spots than it has unblinking eyes, end quote. The plaintiffs got caught 2 to 3 times a day, miles apart, 45 to 50 minutes between hits. Carpenter had 100 plus data points a day. The court said that the captures in Carpenter were 30 to 50 times greater than in this case. So the judge said he didn't reach, it didn't reach the whole of your movements, not in Norfolk and not today.
Did he actually say not today?
He did. He wrote that, the answer to the ALPR crosses the line was, quote, elusive, but that, quote, at least in Norfolk, Virginia, the answer is not today, end quote. And here's the part I want people to hear because it's a tale. Several judges, including this one, cautioned that these cameras multiply the balance, quote, could conceivably tip the other way, end quote. So basically, the court is telegraphing that you people need to be careful what you're doing. And Judge Davis said, quote, the undersigned agrees with these cautionary statements, end of quote.
So hold on. He agrees that it could tip the other way, and he rules for the city anyway?
Because you didn't get there yet. He's telling you that you're getting closer. I'm getting concerned, but you need to give me more proof. You need to be more convincing. So, but you've got my attention. So he agreed it could tip, but he ruled for the city anyway. And I want to be precise because this matters. The caution could conceivably tip the other way. That's dicta. It's not a holding. The holding was that the system on the facts is constitutional, and dicta does not limit anything. It's the judge clearing his or her throat about the future while doing nothing about the present. Don't get giddy about that line. But it also is good that the court is saying, be careful, because somebody may bring a case that changes this down the road.
Something I don't think is going to come up here at all is that this is similar to what happens in a lot of our cases where we challenge that this registry scheme is unconstitutional. And they're like, no, this one is constitutional. But if you keep stacking these things on there, you know, we'll have to reevaluate this later. This sounds very, very similar to that storyline.
It does.
All right. So where does the court say the fix should come from, if not from him?
From you and we.
Me?
The people.
Me?
From the legislature.
Oh, the people.
He said the guardrails were, quote, best achieved with input from the public, with guardrails erected by the state legislature or local governing bodies, end quote. I agree with that. We don't want people that have been anointed with a robe to make public policy. They're interpreters, which was the court's polite way of saying, don't look at me, go vote. Which brings me to something I keep coming back to on this one. Nobody voted for any of this. It didn't arrive by statute. It arrived by procurement. A department signed a subscription agreement. That's how the surveillance got built. Not a bill, not a hearing, just simply a purchase order.
And also probably licensing it the way they did. They didn't have the upfront cost of trying to put in whatever it was, 176 cameras. They're just paying the monthly fee. And that changes it on accounting, I guess, from a capital expenditure to something that's just an ongoing thing.
Well, and the big old bad federal government probably paid for those cameras, because that's been the fixation we've had since 9/11 is to get cameras all over the country. And the federal government's been paying the cost of this in every city, including my city of any size. Every city has cameras all over the place now.
Hmm. So then going back a second, that's a good bridge to the reporting, because now let me tell you about how these networks actually get used, because the court was describing stolen cars and Amber Alerts. The reporting was describing something else. The EFF, remember, that's the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which I can wholeheartedly attest to. You should donate money. I do every month. Blah, blah, blah. The EFF looked at more than 12 million searches across more than 3,900 agencies, and they documented categories. First one, protest. Agencies logged hundreds of searches tied to demonstrations. The February 50501 protest, I don't know what that is, but that's what they found. The April hands-off protests, the No Kings protests from June through October. EFF said 19 agencies ran dozens of searches targeting No Kings protesters alone.
That means the system that was sold to town for stolen cars gets pointed at people carrying signs. That's funny.
So, but it got worse. Category two, ethnicity. EFF found more than 80 agencies used stereotypical language in their queries between June 2024 and October 2025. Now, I have to read this one because it's ugly. I guess I got to have you read it because of that. But so Grand Prairie PD in Texas searched using a racial slur 6 times through a feature called Convoy, which identified groups of vehicles traveling together. The query text included, quote, Roma traveler and, quote, possible G-word. The slur for Romani people, they typed that into the search box.
Well, see, and I'm not smart enough to know. I'm ignorant here. Roma traveler and G-word. So I need a little more explanation.
Well, according to Wikipedia, Romani people are an ethnic group originated in northern India and migrated into Europe roughly 1,000 years ago. So kind of in your time frame. They're Europe's largest ethnic minority. The older exonym is Gypsy, a name that came from a medieval mistake. that Europeans thought they'd come from Egypt, and now it's widely treated as a slur, which is why EFF rendered it as G*PSY in the reporting. The persecution history is severe and continuous, enslaved in Wallachia and Moldavia until 1856, and on and on. It's like similar to the Holocaust and so forth in how they were treated and whatnot.
Okay, well, tell me why this is the tightest analogy in the segment, tighter than ice.
Well, look at the EFF's findings, what they actually describe. More than 80 agencies putting ethnic descriptors into query field. Grand Prairie PD running a slur six times through the convoy feature, the function that identifies groups of vehicles traveling together. That's the part that's worth sitting with. The tool and the prejudice fit each other exactly. A feature built to flag vehicles moving in groups aimed at an ethnic group stereotyped for traveling in groups. There's no crime in that query. The search is, these people are around. That's a pure status search with no offense attached, and it's why it maps onto our audience better than the immigration material does. The ICE searches at least gestured at an immigration violation. The Romani searches gestured at nothing. They're a query run against an ethnicity because the officer found its presence suspicious. And then structurally, Romani Americans occupy the position registrants occupy, a group with a durable stereotype, essentially no political constituency and no organized offenders who will take a public cost for them. And that's the actual mechanism behind your original point. It isn't the sentiment transfers. It's the search that happens when nobody will make it expensive. So you want to put me want me to put this. Excuse me. Go on. Sorry. I was about to read your part.
They typed in an ethnic slur in the audit log, and all this is over my head, into the log, which means that it's recorded. It's sitting there, and nothing in the system stopped the search from running. Think about that. The bigotry is memorialized in the query execute anyway, and I was saying I didn't think technology could be biased, but apparently it can.
Yep. So then let's move on to the final category, and I'm sure this is going to trigger some number of people on both sides. So category three is abortion. Texas deputies used flock data in October to investigate a woman's self-managed abortion. They characterize it as, quote, death investigation of a, quote, non-viable fetus. And a Johnson County official ran searches with a note that said, quote, had an abortion, search for female, end quote. One of those queries reached 83,000 cameras across nearly the entire country.
One query, 83,000 cameras? Is that what you said?
That's what I said, buddy.
To find a woman who ended a pregnancy. Now, I want to name what all three of these have in common, because it's the spine of why this matters to our audience. Every one of these was a status search. Protester, Romani, woman who had an abortion. They're not searching for a specific crime with a specific suspect and specific evidence. They're searching for who a person is. That's the move they're making, a query run against a person for who they are rather than what they've done.
And that's before we get into the federal piece. 404 Media got records out of Danville, Illinois Police Department, and they showed flock search logs from departments all over the country. More than 4,000 nation and statewide lookups done at federal direction or as, quote, informal favors, or with an immigration focus. And the justifications officers typed in included, quote, immigration, ICE, plus ERO, illegal immigration, and ICE warrant, end quote.
And ICE has a contract with flock, I assume.
That's the thing, Larry. ICE had no contract with flock. None. It got the data by asking local police just by a phone call, a favor. Hey, buddy, can you look this up for me? And here's a wild one. 404 Media found Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission police, the wildlife cops, ran 38 flock searches with immigration justifications in January. Each one reached more than how many? 5,000 different flock networks. That became possible after roughly 800 of their officers got enrolled in the 287G program, which handled state officers, federal immigration authority.
Now, you just said 287G, and I'm not familiar with that. What is that?
So this is it's Section 287G of the Immigration and Nationality Act. It's the provision that lets ICE deputize state and local police to do federal immigration work. From ICE's own page, it authorizes ICE to delegate to state and local law enforcement officers the authority to perform specified immigration officer functions under the agency's direction and supervision. A local agency signs a written agreement with ICE. ICE trains and certifies specific named officers, and those officers can then exercise federal immigration authority while remaining employees to the sheriff or the state agency ICE runs, employee to the sheriff or the state agency ICE runs three models. So they run jail enforcement, task force, and warrant service officers. That's what the 287G piece is.
So let me make sure I've got this correct, because there's a big question. ICE needs no contract, no warrant, no new statute, no new authority. It just needs a phone call to the local department that already has a flock login. Is that what you're telling me?
That is the whole apparatus. The capability was already built in and it's been paid for. And Flock's response, and for what it's worth, was that it blocked immigration cooperation, quote, in cities and states where cooperating with federal immigration is against the law, end quote, which tells you the default everywhere else.
And now you see why I keep circling back to the first question. Who's holding the data? A vendor. Who can query it? Anyone the vendor gives a login, plus anyone you can talk to login who has a login to doing you a favor. There's no statute connecting these steps, and there's no statute forbidding them, so they're not authorized, they're not forbidden. And here's the principle I want people to sit with. The absence of a law forbidding something is not the same as a rule against it. There's no law that says ICE can pick up the phone, but there's no law that says it can't. And the gap, and with that gap, the phone just rings, and guess what?
Well, let's talk about some money, because you asked who profits. Flock raised $275 million in March of 2025 at a $7.5 billion valuation led by Andreessen Horowitz. More than $300 million in annual recurring revenue, up 70% year over year. It's a Y Combinator company. TechCrunch called it, quote, Y Combinator's police surveillance darling, end quote. Now, some of those terms are right up your alley because you watch a lot of the markets, because you send me stock ticker stuff every day.
So there's venture capital, and this is what you're saying, which means there are returns riding on the expansion. The business model is subscriptions to towns. Every town you sign up is future recurring revenue. So the incentive isn't fewer cameras, it's more towns, more clusters, more coverage. And that answers who profits and who the public got to vote against, which is nobody. You didn't get a ballot that said, shall we let a venture backed company blanket the county and rent the pictures back to the police. It just showed up. Now, you got to admit that that's funny.
And I should say, because we're being careful, there is a company called Palantir that had a big ICE contract. Immigration OS is what that one's called. $30 million, finalized last April. And Palantir's federal money was up enormously, roughly $1 billion in obligations in one fiscal year. But I want to be clear about what we are not saying.
We are not saying Flock feeds Palantir. There's no documented pipeline from one to the other, and I'm not going to assert one. That's not the argument. The argument isn't a secret integration. The argument is an assembled capability with no connecting statute. Local cameras collect it. Flock stores it. Local police can be asked to run it. And the federal government has platforms for fusing immigration data. No law connects the steps and no law forbids them. That's plenty. I don't need a conspiracy. The pieces sitting next to each other on the table are the problem.
All right. Now, I've got one other thing that I want to cover, and that's to flag up front exactly what it is, because it cuts again a lot of what you just said, and I think that's the point of keeping it, that it's not from the Schmidt opinion, that is not from EFF or 404 Media. A paralegal who follows the program wrote to us, and he was relaying an account about his daughter, who's a law enforcement officer in Virginia and uses Flock alerts on her patrol beat. So I want to be honest, this is secondhand and two versions removed, whatever. Her operational account is firsthand to her, but nobody on the show witnessed any of it, and I can't independently check a word of it. I'm going to keep her generic, a law enforcement officer in Virginia.
Good. Report as what it is and go ahead and tell us what she said.
All right. So her account is, on her beat, they rarely use Flock for anything but stolen vehicles and Amber Alerts. They're too busy to use it for much else. She confirms she cannot tell who's driving, not from behind, not at all. The data stored entirely by Flock. Her locality pays for the subscription. An officer can set the system to detect a specific plate, but needs a documented reason. And department policy makes misuse a terminable offense. They're actually trained on real cases of officers abusing plate lookups. It's not used for registrant notifications in her jurisdiction. A hit is live. It tells them a car is present right now so they can respond. And on approach, if the driver is not the person they're after, the vehicle's released immediately. No delay. That's her account.
So this is a department using it narrowly with discipline, with training on abuse cases, and with misuse being, you get fired. I'm not going to pretend I didn't just hear that. That's a real counterweight to everything that we've read a minute ago. And here's how I hold both things at once. The abuses the Electronic Frontier Foundation and 44 Media documented happened in departments where the policy didn't hold or it didn't exist. This is a department where a policy apparently does hold. And the difference between the two is a policy, not a law. Discretion is not a protection. A policy that can be revoked is not a right. Her department could get a new police chief tomorrow in a different memo, and the capability is still identical. The restraint is real, and it's exactly the point. The departmental, and it's revocable. It's the department imposing discipline on itself.
Now, she also volunteered a couple honest things, too. She doesn't think the public understands how limited these are. Her own explanation for why Flock keeps beating legal challenges is that you're on a public road, so your privacy interest is diminished, which is exactly what the Knott's baseline and the Schmidt court runs on. And then, walking her dogs around the block, she caught herself realizing she could read every license plate sitting in people's driveway.
That's an honest person. She talked herself right up to the edge of it.
But here's the case that she brought that I think is the spine of the whole segment. And again, I can't verify it. No case name, no court, no date, and a trial-level acquittal in Virginia wouldn't show up in any reporter or database, so there's nothing to look at. It's a person's account. It's a man was approaching a woman on a public park walking trail. Three separate incidents. Allegedly ran up, grabbed them, ran off. Mild descriptions, no leads. An officer in another county made a connection to someone they'd apprehended before, and Flock data placed a plate registered to the suspect in the area for all three incidents. He was brought in, questioned, charged, tried. Didn't testify, verdict, not guilty.
And so my screen died.
Oh, my God.
So I'm trying to get it back. So where were we?
Okay. Somewhere down towards the end. I'm highlighting the areas where we were.
All right. Got it again. So all right. So what was the defense argument against that?
Oh, so one sentence. The state's best evidence, the Flock data, established the presence of a registered vehicle, not the presence of the defendant. His vehicle is not him.
And there it is. That's the whole thing. I want the registry audience to hear this because it's the one useful weapon in the entire segment. The same limitation cuts both ways. Schmidt survives constitutional challenge partly because the system tracks a car and not a person, which is why it doesn't reach the whole of your physical movements. And the identical limitation is why it fell apart as proof at trial. The system is constitutional because it can't identify you. And it's weak evidence for exactly that same reason. Evidence the car was somewhere is not evidence that a person was somewhere. And it cannot identify the driver who was actually driving. It's proving a vehicle passed a pole. That's it.
Well, then, so how does this reach our audience concretely?
Well, here's the practical part, and I want to be careful to the rest of this on the opinion, because the opinion is what solid. A sex offense registry is a status list, exactly the kind of list that one of those abuses queried against. Immigration status, ethnicity, reproductive status. A registry is who a person is, not what they did. And it's already assembled, already shared between jurisdictions, and in most states already tied to a specific vehicle. Nothing new would have to be built or authorized to run the same query that ICE allegedly ran. And that's my third question answered. What stops a registry compliance unit from running the query? A department policy if you're lucky, and nothing at all if you're not.
So what do you think actually then happens?
I think registry compliance units will reach for this data once they figure out it's there. And it won't arrive as an announced policy. It will surface in a failure to register prosecution down the road, if it hasn't already, for an exclusion zone case or a loitering allegation, where suddenly the evidence is a string of flock hits on your plate near a school or a park. And when that day comes, the defense that works is the one that's already worked in that acquittal on the reasoning of the Schmidt court itself supplies. A vehicle is not a person. Flock output is location evidence and the registered vehicle, not proof that you are behind the wheel. Make the state prove that the driver, who the driver was, because the camera cannot.
And the Fourth Circuit's got Schmidt on appeal, number 26-1227. The ACLU and EFF filed an amicus in April. Doesn't that fix it?
No. And that's where I want to manage expectations, because people love to pin hope on the next appeal. Whatever the Fourth Circuit does with Schmidt, I don't think it delivers a rule that stops any of this. And here's why even registrant favorable ruling won't help much. Everything in Schmidt is about collection. Step one, where they're taking and storing the pictures is a search. Even if a court someday holds collection needs a warrant, that reaches the collection. It doesn't reach the vendor holding the data. It doesn't reach the money, and it doesn't reach the informal phone call. That's the part I keep hammering. People think a warrant requirement is a fix. The problem isn't process. The problem is collection plus informal access. You can put a warrant on the front door while the whole thing walks out the side door as a favor.
So nothing really gets undone here?
Nothing here gets undone by litigation. The capability is built, it's paid for. The money's on the expansion side, and it keeps growing faster than law tracking it. And I'll be honest about the old shape of this, because it's not a decision I can score a win or a loss. It's landscape, and the landscape is moving against everybody on a list. Courts blessed the collection. The documented misuse ran against one disfavored group after another. The money is accelerating, and the only thing standing between the register and the status query is a department internal policy, which is to say nothing that a memo can't erase immediately.
Well, as usual, Larry, you're pretty doom and gloom. That sounds pretty grim.
Oh, well, I just can't help myself, can I? So, do you want me to read all this gobbledygook here?
You don't have to if you don't want to.
So, I think we've covered this as best we can.
Do you think, if we collectively, if we all voted and said no flock, I mean, does that have to come from your sheriff? Does that have to come from your city council? Does that have to come from your state?
Well, I don't see that as a possible vote to take, because the law enforcement apparatus is going to cry foul. They're going to say that they need this. These are vital tools that solve countless crimes. That's what they're going to say. And it's going to be very difficult to get a city council or county commission or a state legislature to say you can't do these things. So rather than going to lawmakers, we need to develop the policies to present and try to get them adopted. And we need to be the model of the law ourselves and take it in. But there's going to be extreme pushback. When something is established, in particular, how much money did you say? It was hundreds of millions?
Yeah, they've raised a crap ton. So Flock raised $275 in March, so over a year ago, year and a half ago almost, and at a $7.5 billion valuation.
Yeah, the market cap of the company is quite large.
Yes.
So I didn't even know they existed.
That machinery is.
I didn't even know they existed. I never heard of it until this thread started.
Oh, I see. All right. Yeah, I've been following it, because what I have heard, and we didn't put any of this in there, is I've heard that they're putting Bluetooth little beacons on the cameras themselves. So now they get your car, and if your Bluetooth is turned on your phone, and almost everybody's is, well, then they actually have a ping of your phone. Now, is your phone you? No. Could I carry your phone, Larry? Yes. But I, like, you know, you're crossing off another. It's probably not. Like, are fingerprints unique? No. But you eliminate a lot of people with them.
Indeed.
You can definitively say it's not that person. It's not that person. And that leaves us with you. And same thing with the Bluetooth beacon. So now everybody that's in your car, as they take a picture of it, all of them would show up pinging their Bluetooth signals as you're driving around too.
Sounds very promising, doesn't it?
Perfect. I like it that we have a surveillance state. Let's keep it up. Because, you know, we got to just say, if it saves one child, Larry.
Well, but it's the natural progression of technology. The technology progresses faster than any lawmaker can react.
Yeah, that is very, very, very true.
I mean, we don't know. All right. We don't know all the sinister things they're going to think of until they're being done. And then it's hard to unravel them because they're going to tell you that they've solved so many crimes because of these cameras.
Absolutely. Well, hey, if you like this kind of segment, then please head over to registrymatters.co and you can find links to everything, show notes and places to buy merch and whatnot. Email us at registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can leave Larry an old-fashioned voicemail message at 747-227-4477. And thank you to the patrons hanging out tonight, all dozen or so of you, and that is at patreon.com/registrymatters. We are independent creators here, and we rely on your donations to make it all worthwhile for us to keep this up. And you can then also head over to fypeducation.org/shop to find some cool merch. You got any merch, Larry?
I don't have any merch, but I'm waiting for the chance to buy that shirt for someone who wears it to the polygraph exam.
That's right. That's right. That's right. Anything else before we head out? We're running a tad long, but I think this was fine.
So, no, I think we got it covered.
All right. Well, I hope you have a good night and stay out of trouble, and I will talk to you soon.
Good night.
Bye.
You've been listening to FYP.